Thank you very much for inviting me here, and it's always very nice to be back here at the Perimeter Institute. So I'm going to speak to you today about some work I've been doing for the past few years in the information paradox. Let me just start by giving you the context for this, which is something that many of you may be familiar with. But the context for this entire talk is a seeming clash between two very robust predictions of classical general relativity and quantum mechanics. And these predictions are as follows. If you look at classical general relativity, then it gives you a rather robust prediction, which was understood, you know, now many, many decades ago, that if you take a big enough black hole, you take a black hole like the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy, and you look at its horizon, then this horizon locally is indistinguishable from flat space. So even though, you know, many of our astrophysics colleagues study these dramatic phenomena around black hole horizons, if you're just a little local observer who's falling through the horizon, you don't even know when you've crossed the horizon. Related to that, if you start quantizing fields on this background, then you believe that effects of quantum gravity don't become important until you reach pretty close to the black hole singularity. And that's because of the first statement, which is that the black hole horizon is a rather smooth kind of place, which looks a lot like flat space. But there's been a lot of recent work which has used the information paradox in a way that I'll summarize, which has tried to argue that, in fact, this very robust prediction of effective field theory is wrong, and maybe quantum gravity effects are so strong that they reach all the way out to the horizon. And this is called sometimes the firewall proposal, and it's a very interesting proposal because it suggests this very unusual violation of effective field theory. Unfortunately, I think I'm going to try and argue that even though the world would have been a more interesting place if this had been correct, in fact, there is another resolution, a more conservative resolution to the information paradox. And this resolution relies on a certain aspect though, of local operators in quantum gravity. So if I'd like you to take back one punchline from this entire talk, it's the statement that if you look at local operators in quantum gravity, and you're in a particular state of the system, which is given by psi, then the effective field theory operators that you measure, these local operators, depend in a subtle way on the state of the system psi. So they are state dependent. And if you are willing to grant this feature, and this is a feature that's also been explored by other authors, in particular by the word Lindes, then you can resolve all of these versions of the information paradox. So I'm just making this statement right now. I'm not telling you why it's true, but I'll try and explain what the information paradox is and how you can resolve it by using these state dependent operators. And in particular, in this talk, I'd like to point out why this feature of state dependence is necessary, and why it's necessary not only in the presence of black holes formed from collapse, but why it's necessary also in the situation where you have just eternal black holes in anti-de Sitter space. And then there's been some debate in the literature about whether this proposal is consistent, and I'm going to try and argue that it is. And then I'm going to try and show how there's some new consequences to this construction of the black hole interior, in particular that you get a precise version of something called the ER equals EPR proposal, which I'll try and describe. And in the end, if I have time, I'll talk about some possible semi-classical origins of this phenomena of state dependence. But let's see if I have time to go to that. So this is an overview of my talk. I want to talk before I talk about this recent. This is oscillating a little. Is that okay? So there's some gravity fluctuations. But before I go to these versions of the new versions of the information paradox, I want to talk a little about the old information paradox. I'll try and talk about what I call the modern information paradox. Modern and old is decided by whether it's more than 3 years old or less than 3 years old. And then I'll talk about these more recent pieces of work. And I'll talk about how you can resolve them. And then the other features that I mentioned, how you can resolve these ambiguities and make a relation with ER equals EPR. OK, so let me try and get the old information paradox out of the way. The old information paradox is as follows. It says that when you quantize fields around black holes, then Hawking showed us many 4 decades ago that you get Hawking radiation, and Hawking radiation is universal black body radiation. So in particular, you might think from this computation of Hawking radiation that you take a star, you form it out of steel, or you take a star which is formed out of some other material, one star which had more hydrogen, some other star which had more helium, and in the end, you still get universal black body radiation. And if it was really true that this was the case, then that would be a violation of a rather sacred principle of physics, both quantum and classical, which is that dynamics should be reversible. So if it was really true that for different kinds of stars formed from different kinds of collapse, all leading to black holes, if you got the same kind of universal black body radiation, then it would imply that there would be a loss of information and a loss of unitarity, and that would be rather bad, and this looks like a paradox. And another way to say this is to say that you take a small black hole, you throw the library into it, and the small black hole eats up the library, it becomes a big black hole. After it becomes a big black hole, it emits some radiation, so you're back to the situation where you had a small black hole in a library, and now you have a small black hole in radiation. So it looks like the black hole acted like a perfect shredder. And you know, there should be no such thing as a perfect shredder in nature. Everything, every time you shred a piece of paper, if someone works hard enough, they can put the piece of paper back together. But the black hole looks like it's acting like a perfect shredder. And that would be a problem if that was correct. Now, there's a standard resolution to this paradox, which is that you look at very small corrections to Hawking's computation, and that can resolve these paradoxes. And this was put in a rather firm footing by Maldacena in 2001 in a modified version of the information paradox in a study of quasi-normal modes. But one way to say it is to say that if you have a large enough system means its density, you know, the number of states is e to the s, which is very large. And then in this large enough system, you can have a pure density matrix and a thermal density matrix. And for a large class of observables, it can look like these density matrices are basically the same and indistinguishable. And this is just a mathematical fact. You can construct examples of pure density matrices that mimic the thermal density matrix to excellent accuracy. And another way of saying this is that you can write a pure density matrix as a thermal density matrix plus some very small corrections. So these corrections don't show up in correlation functions of many kinds of different kinds of observables. And a colloquial way of saying that would be to say that information is encoded in very small correlations of the Hawking quanta. And how small, you can quantify that in exponentially small correlations of the Hawking quanta. Now you in fact believe that such corrections should exist, and what is more, you have very little control over them. And the reason you believe such corrections should exist to any effective field theory calculation you do is easy to see if you formulate gravity by using a path integral. So if you formulate gravity by using a path integral and you're summing over metrics, then you might naively have asked, what does it mean, you know, even to do effective field theory about a background? And the answer is that you're looking at a saddle point of the path integral, and about that saddle point, the correlation functions you're computing are an asymptotic series expansion about that saddle point. And therefore, you know that when this asymptotic series expansion breaks down, and you have non-perturbative effects, then you don't even have locality in hand, and effective field theory can't help you fix CZ to the minus S corrections, because even the notion of a space-time breaks down at that level. So therefore, when sometimes people say, you know, where is the mistake in Hawking's computation, that's not really a well-defined question, because Hawking's original computation is framed within effective field theory, and it's not precise enough to rule out these e to the minus s corrections. And therefore, if it was really the case that these exponentially small corrections could fix the information paradox, and as I showed you, they can, at least this old version of the information paradox, then there is no contradiction with any calculation, and you don't have to worry anymore. You know, if unitarity tells you these computations, these corrections exist, then they exist, and there's no contradiction with effective field theory, because effective field theory is not powerful enough to compute these kinds of terms. So that's the resolution to the old information paradox. Are there any questions about this at this point? I'm just reviewing some old story, but if there are any questions about this here, maybe I could take them. Yeah.
Is it known what the form of the is? Like, in the original thing, it said that, for example, sums over things with different topologies would create these corrections. Then I thought people since then studied it and said actually it was unlikely that those topologies.
Well, I think that the central point is not whether you can get, you know, I think that debate of whether you get precisely that by those corrections by summing over different topologies or not is not the issue. You know, whether you can identify the precise saddle points. Maldacena, it's true, had a particular proposal for a different saddle point, but whether or not you can identify them. If the general principle is that corrections of that size can fix it, then you know you can fix it. Whether there's another saddle point that corresponds to that or whether there's no saddle point, I mean, that's a matter of details. In particular, maybe there's no saddle point. I mean, he did identify a particular saddle point. But the important factor is the magnitude of the corrections that are required. And in this framing, those corrections look like they're pretty small. Okay. So now, in more recent work, now I'm turning to the modern information paradox, starting with the work of Mathur. Not 3 years, maybe 5 years ago. And Mathur started to argue that this belief that many people held was actually wrong. And in fact, small corrections are not enough to resolve the information paradox. And the original argument that Mathur had used the strong subadditivity of entropy, and this is an argument that seems to have persisted with many people. But in fact, the more robust arguments were constructed by a group of people at KITP and at Stanford by what's called the AMPS collaboration or the AMPSS collaboration. And these more robust arguments are not based on the strong subadditivity of entropy, but rather they're framed within the ADS-CFT conjecture, and they're also making a much stronger statement. What these more robust arguments, which I'll review, are saying is that even if you have a large black hole, and there's some big gas of dust which collapses into a black hole, and this blue line is the horizon, and even if you fall in much after all this dust has passed, then actually you hit this red line, which is a firewall, and there's no smooth horizon at that place. So they're making a strong statement, which is that even large black holes in ADS have firewalls. And in some sense, the arguments for this, I think, are more robust than the original arguments for the strong subadditivity of entropy. So I want to take you through these arguments. But before that, I just want to point out that I'll take you through these arguments in a slightly different setting, which is that if these arguments are correct, then they apply not only to large single-sided black holes, but also to what is called the eternal black hole, which is a black hole which is dual to two CFTs and has existed forever. And as we showed, you could extend these arguments to the eternal black hole, and you could then argue that even the eternal black hole has firewalls. And that would be a very unpleasant kind of conclusion, because we have various calculations and various pieces of evidence that suggest that the eternal black hole has a smooth interior. And so what I would actually like to point out is that conversely, a state-dependent construction of the interior, which I'll review, can resolve all these paradoxes, not only for the single-sided black hole, but also for the eternal black hole. So now I'm going to take you through one of these arguments for firewalls, but I'll take you through that argument in a slightly modified context, not in the original AMPSS setting, but in terms of this eternal black hole setting. Okay, before I do that, let me just remind you that this eternal black hole is dual to an entangled state of two CFTs. It has two boundaries. One CFT lives on this side, the other CFT lives on that side. And there's a precise proposal for the entangled state of the CFT that's dual to the eternal black hole. It's this state. It's called the thermophile double state. That's why this TFD. And it's a particular state where you sum over pairs of energy eigenstates with a factor of e to the minus beta e. And there's this one important fact I'd like to remind you about in the boundary, which is that you have a killing time or a Schwarzschild time. The killing time is what causes rotations about this bifurcation point. And if you look at this killing time, or the Schwarzschild time, the way it's glued to time on the left boundary is with a time flip. So while on the right boundary, which is on this side, you identify Schwarzschild time with time in the CFT, on this side, time runs the other way, so Schwarzschild time gets associated with minus of the CFT time. And corresponding to that, you see that there's an isometry in the bulk, which is just rotations, shifts of the Schwarzschild time. And the isometry in the bulk corresponds to this identity for the thermophile state, which is that e to the ihr minus hl into t leaves the thermophile state invariant. So that's just one fact about the geometry, which I wanted to remind you of. Now I want to consider, so I'm going to come to the information paradox in a second. I just want to remind you about just some various classes of states which are dual to various geometries. The next class of states I want to consider are states where you take the thermophile state and you shift it in time by evolving with the left Hamiltonian only. If you evolve with the left Hamiltonian, you see that you just, and the CFT is some well-defined thing, you get some bunch of phases next to this Boltzmann factor, and these phases are just e into t. Okay. Now you might wonder what the state is, but in fact we understand very well in quantum gravity what the state is, and that's because in quantum gravity we know that time evolution by the Hamiltonian always corresponds to a large diffeomorphism. And this is a very well-established statement in quantum gravity, but it's not something for which you need to use the equations of motion or make any additional assumptions. Therefore, this state, which is the thermophile state acted on with e to the ihlt, or this state in the CFT with these phases, in fact, just corresponds to a large diffeomorphism acting on the original thermophile state, which dies off at the right boundary but not at the left boundary, and that's because I evolved with the left Hamiltonian and not with the right Hamiltonian. So this is a robust statement. So in particular, you might think of this diffeomorphism as shifting nice slices as follows. Now here's my eternal black hole. I have a nice slice that runs from left to right. The action of e to the ihlt shifts all points in a nice slice in this way. But this is just a picture, and it's important that there's no unique diffeomorphism that corresponds to this large diffeomorphism. Okay? So you can write down, or the last bottom of it is getting cut off, but okay, it's not so important. You can write down a particular diffeomorphism. This is a diffeomorphism in terms of the U and V Kruskal coordinate that performs this shift on, that performs this large diffeomorphism on this geometry. But there are many other possible diffeomorphisms that you could have written down that would have induced the same shift on the boundary. So this is one example. You can write down concrete examples, but there is no unique diffeomorphism that corresponds to this large diffeomorphism. And the reason for that is that all large diffeomorphisms that differ by trivial diffeomorphisms, and a trivial diffeomorphism is one that dies off at both boundaries, all large diffeomorphisms that differ by trivial diffeomorphisms are equivalent. That's how you quantize the theory. And therefore, you can undo this large diffeomorphism everywhere except for a region which is infinitesimally close to the left boundary. So really, the only gauge invariant statement you can make about the action of this e to the IHLT is that it shifts the boundary up by some amount given by this amount t. And therefore, in particular, it leaves all intrinsic properties of the geometry invariant. It doesn't change anything intrinsic about the geometry, such as the question of whether this, the right observer sees a smooth horizon or the left observer sees a smooth horizon, but it glues the geometry differently to the boundary. Remember, I said that the earlier thermofield was glued with a time shift where you identified T Schwarzschild with minus TL. Here you identify T Schwarzschild with minus TL plus T. So this is a concrete proposal for what are the geometric duals to these kinds of states, which are the thermofield state evolved with the left Hamiltonian. Okay, now the next important thing is that, as I said, this is a very robust statement. And because it's so robust, because I didn't use any equations of motion in making this statement, and therefore I'm going to claim that this is an exact statement. In particular, it holds even if I make exponentially large shifts by, you know, shifts by times of the size e to the n squared into LADS. Okay? And you might wonder how I'm making such statements, because usually you do not use the geometry to make statements about exponentially large time shifts. But the thing is that there are independent CFT, there's an independent CFT motivation for the statement, and the independent CFT motivation is simply that there's no common origin of time in the two CFTs. So if you just choose the origin of time in a different way on the left CFT, then you would have got these time-shifted states. So, and there's another, you know, there are other pieces of evidence you can give for this strong statement. The fact that all of these states, which are shifted by exponentially long times as well, are smooth, corresponds to the statement that the right infalling observer sees the same geometry in the eternal black hole whenever the right infalling observer falls in. So there are many pieces of evidence, and this CFT statement in some sense is the strongest piece of evidence for this exact statement, that make it evident that all of these states, regardless of, you know, how long you do this time evolution by, are all corresponding to smooth geometries. Okay? So this is going to be an important input in now in my setting up now the information paradox. Okay. So now I'm going to set up the information paradox as follows. I'm going to say if you attempt to find CFT operators, okay, that have the property that they behave like local bulk operators in all of these states, you know, not only in the original thermofield state, but they have to have the correct properties, which I'll make precise, in all of these states, then we will run into versions of these AMPSS paradoxes, which I'll show you. And I'm going to use that to conclude that you have to therefore resolve this paradox by using the state-dependent construction of the black hole interior. Okay, so what do I mean by saying that these operators have to have the right properties? What I mean is the following. The claim is that you want to find operators in the CFT that behave like local operators in the bulk in all of these time-shifted states. Okay, psi t is one of these time-shifted states. And I'm going to try and argue that there is no operator phi fx in the CFT, so that when you look at its correlation functions in one of these time-shifted states, so you take some of these, you know, you take this operator phi fx with points defined relationally with respect to the right boundary, you take its correlators, effective field theory gives you a prediction for what such a correlator has to be. Effective field theory tells you that this correlator is what you get by quantizing fields in the eternal black hole background. So the right-hand side of this thing is fixed, and I'm going to claim that there is no operator phi fx in the CFT, so that you can get CFT correlators that match with these effective field theory correlators. Now you might ask what this has to do with the information paradox. This talk is supposed to be about the information paradox. And the reason this is still a version of the information paradox is not only because it was inspired by that, but because this is still a conflict between unitarity and effective field theory. So I'm going to try and say that this, the reason such operators don't exist is because there's some conflict with some rather well-defined principles of unitarity in the CFT, and on the right-hand side you have some prediction from effective field theory, and therefore you have to give up one or the other, and this is precisely what happens in the information paradox as well. Okay, so this is what I'm going to try and show you. So I'll just take you through the proof very fast, and our proof goes as follows. So it's a reductio ad absurdum proof. Assume that there's some operator phi of x, okay? Let's say such an operator existed. Then what you do is you take this operator. So this is the horizon. I've zoomed in on, you know, you have the eternal black hole horizon, but this is the future horizon for the right and falling observer. I just zoomed in on this part of the future horizon. And now when I zoomed in, I do a Fourier transform of this operator phi into its modes O, which correspond to left and right moving modes. And you can easily check this from properties of effective field theory that outside the horizon, the same operators O can play the role of both left and right moving modes, whereas inside the horizon, you need some new degrees of freedom to play the role of right moving modes, and these are these O tilde operators. So for those of you who've looked at Hawking's original paper, these O tildes are the modes that bounce off the origin, the origin at r equal to 0, and come back. Okay, so these are the right moving modes behind the horizon. But even if you don't want to think of that motivation, in this case, all I'm saying is, let's say you assume you had some field which had the right properties to play the role of effective field theory, then you just take this field and Fourier decompose it into its modes. You get only one mode outside because both left and right movers are given by the same mode, and they're related by the normalizable boundary condition at infinity, but you get two different pieces of, you know, you get two different kinds of modes behind the horizon. Now, from effective field theory, you can argue that these modes behind the horizon have somewhat unusual properties. They have somewhat unusual properties in that, first of all, they have the wrong energy. So if you look at the annihilation operator of the right moving mode behind the horizon, it looks like it has positive energy. Corresponding to that, the creation operator behind the horizon looks like it has negative energy. And this is something you get just from an analysis of large diffeomorphisms, but this is something that's also would also be well known to just people who have worked in quantum field theory about black holes, which is if you look at the annihilation and creation operators behind the black hole horizon, they look like they have the wrong energy. So the annihilation operator and the creation operator look like they have the wrong commutators with the Hamiltonian, and that's given by the fact that you have this plus sign here, not a minus sign here. So in particular, if you look at the correlation function in each of these time-shifted states of the right Hamiltonian with this O tilde operator, you just get omega back into the O tilde operator. This AR is just some other insertion I've made in order to make this correlator finite. The important part is that the commutator H with O tilde is O tilde, but in fact, there are two omegas. There should just be one omega, sorry. Okay. And now if you demand also that the two-point function agrees with what you compute from effective field theory, remember I said that the correlators of this phi fx have to correspond to correlators that you get from effective field theory. That tells you, if you decompose it into its modes, that there's the analog of what's called the KMS condition, which is that you look at a correlator of this O tilde with its dagger, and it has to have a certain occupancy, and that can be stated in terms of a relation between the correlator of O tilde and O tilde dagger with O tilde dagger and O tilde. And there has to be a relation of e to the plus beta omega between these guys. So the details of this are not very important, but the two points are that A, there's a prediction for the two-point function which comes from effective field theory, from just doing effective field theory quantization about the black hole, and second, that there's this prediction for the commutator with the Hamiltonian, which also comes from effective field theory. So these are two properties that you expect where you've inputted the statement that these operators behave correctly as local operators in the bulk. And by correctly, I mean they have the same properties as what you would compute from effective field theory. Okay. So now I want to make the following statement. I said that these operators have the right properties in all of these time-shifted states, in all of these states psi t. Now, if that is true, if you have an operator which has a particular expectation value which doesn't depend on time in all of these states psi t, then just remember the definition of these psi t states as e to the iht into the thermofield state. And you see that if you take a long time average, you know, you just average over this quantity, it's a constant, so you're going to get back the same quantity, but the cross terms can't be important. Okay? The cross terms in this sum, if you expand it in energy eigenstates, can't be important. And this term, the sum must be coming only from this part, only from the diagonal terms. This is the only contribution that you can get to this expectation value, and not, you know, the cross terms can't give you a contribution. And then if you also assume some additional statistical properties about the CFT, in particular that there is there's a reasonable way to go from the canonical to the microcanonical ensemble, then you're led to the conclusion that in fact this property of the two-point function and the commutator, which I earlier demanded should hold in all of these time-shifted states, must in fact hold in eigenstate pairs. Okay? So not only in the, should these properties, which is that this guy has the wrong energy and that there's a relation for the two-point function, not only should it hold in all of these time-shifted states, but in fact it should hold in energy eigenstate pairs. And that you get by taking the earlier answer and by just doing a long time average of the earlier answer. Okay, now you already find that you're running into trouble, because the statement is, if there is a paradox which exists for a single-sided black hole, as AMPS has shown, then how can it be that when you take an energy eigenstate pair, where you just have two CFTs, which happen to be in correlated states, but not entangled. Okay, remember, energy eigenstate pairs are not entangled. How can it be that this eigenstate pair somehow allows the existence of operators which describe the interior, whereas a single black hole does not allow the existence of such operators? And to make this more precise, you can assume something called a no-wormhole hypothesis, which is a statement that if you take two eigenstates of the CFT, then they correspond to two disconnected ADSs. You don't know what lives inside the ADS, but as long as you have this eigenstate pair, there's no wormhole that joins this ADS with this ADS because there's no entanglement. Okay? And corresponding to that, you have the statement that if you take this correlation function and you do anything you like, any action of a left unitary, it leaves the correlation function invariant. And that's simply the statement that if you have these disconnected ADSs and you act with a unitary on this, whatever unitary you do, can't propagate its influence to this part. Okay? And that's a very reasonable kind of statement. Okay. Now, you can set up a version of the AMPS's paradoxes, and that's the following. Because you can act with this left unitary, you can just forget about the left energy eigenstate. You can convert it to the vacuum if you like. And then you find that this expectation value of this two-point function can be replaced by a trace only in the right CFT. And if you use the fact that you had a commutator with the Hamiltonian, then you end back that you had the wrong commutator with the Hamiltonian, then you end up with the wrong prediction for the relationship between the annihilation and the creation and the relationship of the two-point function with the creation and the annihilation. And I just want to point out, not that the algebra is not so important, but just that you use rather robust assumptions. One is that the CFT has a good equivalence of the microcanonical and the canonical ensemble. Second, that there's, you know, the trace is cyclic. And finally, that there's a commutator with the Hamiltonian that came from effective field theory. And when you use that, you got a contradiction in that you found the wrong factor here. Instead of e to the plus beta omega, you found e to the minus beta omega. And if you now also assume that, you know, that this commutator has to be positive, this commutator you would expect is proportional to 1 into some positive quantity, then you find that this two-point function has to have a negative expectation. And that's absurd. You know, how can a two-point function of an operator and its adjoint have a negative expectation value in some diagonal state? So this is what leads to a paradox. And the reason this paradox is really a paradox as opposed to the earlier one is that there's no scope for 1 over n corrections to solve this. You know, I could have added 1 over n everywhere here, and I could have added 1 over n here, but this differs from 0 by some order 1 quantity. So it doesn't look like in this situation 1 over n corrections would help you resolve this paradox, and that's why it's a more severe paradox than the paradox we had for the old information paradox, where it looked like small corrections, exponentially small corrections, could resolve it. Okay. Let me just summarize. I'm sorry. Some of this might have been fast for some of you if you haven't seen the argument before. But let me just give you the summary, which is the takeaway, which is that we have a contradiction between the claim that in all of these time-shifted states, all of which we believe correspond to a particular geometry, we believe we know the geometry to that, and that's very robust, that you can find operators that have the right properties to play the role of, you know, effective field theory operators, and that means that their correlators in all of these states should correspond to correlation functions as computed by effective field theory. Okay? And I tried to lead you through the argument for the paradox. It may have been a little fast, but you can go back and look at it. It is really an argument for the paradox, and it's a rather well-posed, robust argument, and therefore AMPSS argued, and if you extend that argument, as I did here, to the eternal black hole, you would say that you have a firewall, and the firewall exists not only in the single-sided black hole, but even in the eternal black hole. Okay? So are there any questions about this? I'm sorry, I may have gone fast. So any questions about this? And in any case, I'd just like at least all of you to get this takeaway, that there's this contradiction between the claim that you know the geometry to all of these states and that you have to find operators that have these correlation functions. And it looks like there's some argument you can't find these operators. Okay, good. So now, how do you resolve this paradox? The resolution is as follows. I'm going to claim that this paradox arose because you ignored the limitations of effective field theory. In particular, you ignored the fact that the infalling observer and that effective field theory only, you know, has access to some subsection of operators. In particular, if you take these modes of single trace operators, you take some light field, some single trace operator, and you Fourier transform it, then the infalling observer can only measure, you know, correlation functions where all the energy of the insertions is small compared to n squared, in that you're not making an insertion with a huge amount of energy, and you're not measuring a correlation function where the number of insertions is very large. Okay? So there's a way of saying that precisely, which is that you look at polynomials in modes of single trace operators, and you truncate these polynomials by putting a bound on the highest possible energy that the infalling observer can measure, and also on the largest degree of the polynomial that the infalling observer can measure. Okay? And that's a reasonable assumption. It's not even a statement about what an infalling observer can measure, but rather a statement about inherent limitations of effective field theory. Now, effective field theory can only tell you expectation values or correlation functions of operators that come from within the set of polynomials. This is not quite what the quantum field theorists or the constructive field theorists would call an operator algebra, because there are these truncations, that all these energies have to be smaller than some amount, and that the total number has to be smaller than some amount. And therefore, if you start multiplying these polynomials, you can go outside the set. And so this is not strictly an algebra, but in some sense, it's an algebra. I'll refer to it as an algebra, even though really it's a set with some limited multiplication relations and some truncations.
Is this restriction stronger than what you normally make in like non-gravitational effective field theory?
Well, is it stronger than what you normally make in non-gravitational? Yeah, maybe. In non-gravitational effective field theory, you could have argued, for example, you know, if you have some CFT, why can't I take two points to be arbitrarily close to each other? And there's no restriction that I can't take them to be closer than Planck scale. You know, you can. There's no Planck scale if you're just working in a conformal field theory. So it is a stronger restriction. And there's no reason that if you're in n equal to 4 super Young Mills, you can measure a correlation function with arbitrary number of insertions.
Right.
There's no limit in that.
But that's not really effective. That's an exact case. See, I was doing with pi on Lagrangian, then I should not do that thing, right? Is it the same sort of restriction?
Yeah, maybe. If you had a pi on Lagrangian, maybe you should not. If you had
probably not much stronger, right?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. So you're right. If you looked at some effect, yeah. But it's true that in a general quantum field theory, if you have an ultraviolet complete description, then you wouldn't expect to have restrictions of this kind. You'd really have an operator algebra, not
right,
these truncations.
Right.
Usually, effective field theories, usually the restrictions are phrased slightly differently in terms of this, and not in terms of limits and number of insertions, but I think this limit also exists. Okay. So corresponding to this, the infalling observer can only access part of the full Hilbert space. You know, even though there's a big Hilbert space of the CFT, the infalling observer can only access what I would call the little Hilbert space, or there's a big Hilbert space which you can't see. Well, on my computer, there's a big Hilbert space that surrounds the little Hilbert space, but the projector doesn't like it. But okay, so the thing is that you have this space, you have these polynomials you can measure. The action of all these polynomials in the space, you know, gives you some span of states that gives you this pink little Hilbert space, and there's a big Hilbert space around here which is not visible, which is a larger Hilbert space of the CFT. And one important fact about this little Hilbert space is that because its dimension is much smaller than, because the dimension of this set of polynomials is much smaller than e to the n, e to the curly n, or the dimension of the Hilbert space, therefore none of these polynomials can annihilate the state. And this is a very physical statement. It's a statement that in effective field theory, if you have a big black hole, you can't make the black hole vanish by doing some experiments in effective field theory. You can't annihilate the black hole by acting on it with excitations that have energy that are much lower than that of the black hole. And therefore, this little Hilbert space is isomorphic to this algebra of operators. And that's something that's important now, but will change later when we go to entangled states. I just want you to keep that in mind. So now here's a definition. So given these operators psi, you define what's called the antilinear map, which is that you take an element in this little, a vector in this little Hilbert space, which is obtained by taking your state psi, acting on it with A, and you know, you define this map S as the antilinear map that takes this vector to A dagger on the same state. And the reason this map is well defined is because of the condition I mentioned a minute ago, which is that none of these vectors is zero. And that's why this gives you a well-defined set of linear equations. And incidentally, this map is the same as the map that appears in what the field theorists study under the name of the Tomita Takesaki theory of modular automorphisms of von Neumann algebras. We did not arrive at this map from that perspective, but after we arrived at it, we realized that it is actually the same as something that the field theorists have studied a lot under this different name. And then the claim is that these mirror operators, these O tildes, are defined by taking ordinary single trace operators, inserting some Boltzmann factors, and using, you know, two copies of this map. Okay? So right now, this is just a definition. I'm not motivating it. But I'm claiming that this actually is correct in that if you then form this operator by taking these mirror operators and multiplying them with some mode functions, which I can write down precisely, and then the claim is that you insert them in these states, which correspond to a black hole, either in a single-sided case or in a double-sided case, and you can explicitly compute these correlation functions, and you find that they are the same as the correlation functions you expect to have got from effective field theory. So this is explicitly consistent with correlators that you get in a weakly propagating spacetime. So the claim is that this map works, even though I haven't shown you that it works, but you can check that it works. Okay? Now you might have asked how you evaded this impossibility theorem. Now it looked like we had an impossibility theorem that you couldn't find such operators. The way you evaded the impossibility theorem is through state dependence, which is by recognizing that this map, this S map that I defined, depended on the state. If you take a different microstate of the black hole, it gives you, you know, you get a different S map, and you get a different set of mirror operators. And in particular, therefore, the local operators that you measure when you're in a microstate psi depend on the microstate of the system. And this information paradox arises very explicitly, as I'll show you in the next slide, by imagining that local degrees of freedom at all points, at some physical point in space, are described by the same operators everywhere in the Hilbert space. And if you drop this assumption, then this paradox goes away. And more precisely, you have to recognize that these phi of x operators may depend on the state psi, as they did in this map that I showed you. Okay? Let me just emphasize that once more. In particular, if you're falling into the state psi, and I can construct these mirror operators, O tilde, so that, you know, in the state psi, in correlation functions of an insertion of one of these polynomials in effective field theory, measured about the state psi, these operators have the right properties, in that they have the right commutator with the Hamiltonian, and they have the right two-point function, which are the two properties that we demanded. So you can explicitly show that in correlation functions measured about this microstate, these operators have the right properties. But if I give you a basis of such states, then I cannot replace the sum of these guys by some trace in the Hilbert space. And the reason is that there is no globally defined O tilde operator that allows you to replace this state-dependent sum where you're summing these different operators that differ in each state with some trace. Okay? And you can, if you look back at the arguments I showed you for the information paradox, this was done twice, you know, in taking this long time average and in taking a trace over energy eigenstates and in using that to arrive at a contradiction. And in both cases, you can see that what one did was tacitly assume that the infalling observer was measuring the same operators at all points in Hilbert space. And if you drop that assumption, then the paradox explicitly goes away, as this calculation shows. And you can see why the paradox arises. It arises because you made this replacement, which is a disallowed replacement. Okay. Let me just say one thing. I've given a couple of talks here. It's not relevant to this conclusion, where we talked about, you know, how to construct the interior of the black hole in terms of a division of the full CFT Hilbert space in terms of coarse and fine degrees of freedom. You know, you said we had some fine degrees of freedom inside and some coarse degrees of freedom outside. This current construction I proposed, it supersedes this, but it reduces to the old construction in a system where the CFT Hilbert space does really factorize, or where you do have a reasonable factorization into some modes that you can measure and some modes you can't. But for those of you who didn't hear these talks earlier, it may not be relevant, but I just wanted to mention it for those of you who did. Okay, so this is the punchline of this part, which is that the use, if you are willing to use an appropriate state-dependent mapping, and I defined it precisely for you, of local operators to operators on the boundary, then this resolves all aspects of the information paradox. I give you a particular argument, one argument. This is what the AMPSS group calls the counting argument. I give you a variant of that, which one might call the counting or the occupancy argument. There are other such arguments, but all of them basically always involve the replacement of some sum over local correlations of local operators with a trace. And if you realize that you can't do that legally, then all of these aspects of the information paradox go away. So that's one punchline I wanted to make. Are there any questions about this? And then I'll move on to new things. Okay. So let me say a little bit about, you know, you might have worried about ambiguities in this paradox. So in particular, let me just say a little bit about whether this definition is consistent. So there's been some debate in the literature. And so when I gave you the construction earlier, I should have specified that, strictly speaking, this construction works in most states. But in most states, the precise set of states it works in are what are called equilibrium states. Equilibrium states are those where the expectation values of these operators, these polynomial operators, don't vary much with time. What does not vary much mean? It means that this variation, when you compute this average, is exponentially suppressed in the entropy. And you can show, indeed, using what's called the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, that most states are equilibrium states. Okay? But not all states are equilibrium states. In particular, you have non-equilibrium states, which is where you take an equilibrium state and you excite it with some excitation. These states are a very small fraction of the Hilbert space. You might ask why we study them. But in some sense, all of us are near equilibrium excitations about an equilibrium. All of us will eventually decay into, you know, thermal nothingness. And therefore, it's important for us to study non-equilibrium phenomena. And any theory that you have has to be able to describe non-equilibrium phenomena as well. And so in these non-equilibrium states, if you give me a state where you take this equilibrium state and excite it with a unitary, then you have to modify the definition a bit. And the way you modify it is rather precise. Given only this state, I can actually detect which equilibrium state it came from and how you excited it. And then you have to modify the definition in this manner. And this gives you, again, answers that are consistent with effective field theory. You might have worried about some other kinds of non-equilibrium states, which are rather perverse, where you take the black hole and you excite it behind the horizon. Now, not by means of some excitation in front of the horizon, but you just perform an excitation behind the horizon, so that from outside it looks like the state is in equilibrium, but actually the state is not in equilibrium because there are some degrees of freedom or some particles that are living behind the horizon. And so you might, you know, if I wasn't careful and I thought this was an equilibrium state, I would get the wrong answer as opposed to effective field theory, or I might find that the same state has ambiguous interpretations, where one it's interpreted as an equilibrium state or the non-equilibrium state. But in fact, that's not true. And the reason that's not true is because there is no such thing as a strictly local operator in quantum gravity. Everything that you do, you know, any local operator that you have has to be related to the boundary, and therefore it fails to commute with the Hamiltonian. And if you're allowed to use insertions of the Hamiltonian, there's a particular insertion, there's a prescription that we have, but the claim is that there are some correlation functions that in an equilibrium state, where this is a bona fide equilibrium state, would be exponentially suppressed, but in an excited state of the kind that I showed you previously, would give you some order one answer. Okay, the details of this are not important, but the point is that by using the Hamiltonian to measure the pattern of energy increase or energy decrease, see, the Hamiltonian itself just measures the total energy. But if you take the Hamiltonian and insert other operators and then look at those correlation functions, then this helps you detect these perverse kinds of excitations which you have behind the horizon. There was some discussion by Daniel Harlow that this would not work, but we believe, and I think we were able to show that this was based, in fact, on a misidentification of the commutator of the Hamiltonian in the thermofield double. And the moment you correct this misidentification and you correctly analyze the effective field theory commutator between the Hamiltonian and these operators in the thermofield double, this ambiguity vanishes. I'm happy to give you more details if you're interested in how we can resolve this particular ambiguity. But the claim is that this is based on this misidentification, which can be resolved. Okay. So this is about the consistency of the construction, about 15 minutes more. Let me try and tell you about some new things that we get out of this construction. Now, so far I said that this construction helps resolve the information paradox. It looks like it's consistent, but what new things do you get from it? And the new thing that you get from it is that you get a precise version of what was called the ER equals EPR conjecture. For those of you who haven't, it's a conjecture between entanglement to EPR states and the Einstein-Rosen bridge, which is a statement about wormholes in black holes. And there was a some kind of relation between entanglement and wormholes that was posited by Malesin and Susskind, but in its original avatar, it wasn't a particularly precise statement about when entanglement leads to wormholes and what the geometry of the wormhole is. And I'm going to try and show you that we can make some more precise statements by applying our construction to the CFT in entangled states. So what I want to do now is entangle the CFT with some other system. So this is your CFT, and I entangle it with some other system. And now I want to try and understand, you know, how this construction gets modified in this setup. Okay? So let me just say this more precisely. You have a set of CFT microstates. You entangle them with some other system, which could be a CFT or a system of qubits. From the point of view of an observer, the observer still sees a black hole because you have a set of microstates. The observer doesn't know that the CFT is entangled with something else. And now I want to construct the interior of this black hole. So what happens is that you have to expand now. The key difference is that you have to expand the set of simple operators, what I was calling simple operators that were measurable in effective field theory, to operators to the original effective field theory operators that the observer could measure, but also to simple observers that can be measured in this system. Okay? And therefore, the full set of simple operators is now a product set which corresponds to simple operators in the original CFT and simple operators in this new entangled system. And corresponding to that, this little Hilbert space, which I defined as a set of all excitations of the original state, now is given by the action of a product on this original entangled state. The key difference with the original setup is that you might have null relations due to entanglement. So if you go back to this thermofield state that I described some time ago, it's just a mathematical fact about the thermofield state that if you take the thermofield state and you act on it with the mode of the left moving single trace operator of a single trace operator in the left CFT, then you get the adjoint of the same single trace operator in the right CFT multiplied with some Boltzmann factors. So this is just an identity about the thermofield state. And as a result of this identity, you can see that there are some elements of this product set, in particular OL minus this guy, which annihilate the original entangled state. And therefore, this Hilbert space, the little Hilbert space, is not isomorphic to this product algebra. Although it's not isomorphic to this product algebra, it's just a simple exercise in representation theory to understand what the structure of this little Hilbert space is. You see, you have a product algebra. It acts on some, if you like, primary state. It produces a set of descendants. But all the null relations involve a linear combination of left plus right acting on primary gives you zero. And therefore, whatever space that you get can always be decomposed into complete representations of the right algebra, which is what I've done here, but not necessarily into complete representations of the A left algebra. Okay? It's just a statement about constructing representations of product algebras. And the number of such representations you get of the right algebra depends on the number of null relations. If there are no null relations, then you would have got as many representations as the dimension of the left algebra. If there are a lot of null relations, then you might get only one. In any case, you get this, and corresponding to every such representation, you define this S operator, and then you just sum all of these S operators, and that gives you a big S operator. And then the mirror operators, the claim is, are given by the same formula I presented earlier. So you just, what you need to define these mirror operators is this S operator, and it's just given by a sum in this situation. Okay. And now you can ask, you've constructed this interior, but now you can ask, how are these operators, which are the modes seen by the right infalling observer falling through the horizon, how are they related to the modes as seen by the observer on the left CFT? Or how are they related to simple observables in the entangling system? Okay? So this is a precise question you'd like to ask to understand the relationship between entanglement and wormholes. Okay? And that's because if you know this relation, then you know what the kind of wormhole is. Okay, so this is the question you'd like to ask. And you can ask this precisely in the CFT. You can ask, what is the commutator of the modes behind the black hole as seen by the right observer, which are these O tildes, and the modes on the left CFT? And what is the two-point function of these guys? And this diagnostic answers this question and tells you about the geometry of the wormhole. So now I'm going to apply this diagnostic to several examples and try and show you how you can try and understand the wormhole geometry using this construction. So the first setup you'd like to understand, which is the standard setup, you'd like to make sure you get that right, is just the thermofield double state, which I already examined in great detail. So you apply this construction, and you find, just by applying the construction, that the commutator, these modes as seen by the right observer, are, you know, have a commutator with the left modes, which is the same as the commutator of the left modes with their adjoint. And they have a two-point function, which is also the same as the two-point function of left modes with their adjoint. So up to 1-by-n corrections, these 1-by-n corrections are important as I'll explain, but up to 1-by-n corrections, if you have these modes on the left boundary, and you have an observer who jumps in from here and goes here, then the modes as seen by this observer are the modes that come from here. And the reason you can say this is because of these relations. The two-point function of the modes as seen here with the left modes, which is this, and the commutator. Okay. So you can, so that's this, the fact that you can compute these two-point functions and commutators lets you argue that the geometry that would be dual to this entangled state would be this thermofield double. Of course, there are many other arguments you can make for it, but this is kind of a direct understanding of how entanglement modifies the geometry. Okay. Now you could ask, and this is a question that Marolf and Polchinski in fact did ask in their paper. They said, take the thermofield state and scramble it by means of some generic unitary. Okay. So take the thermofield and take some unitary which you pick with the Haar measure and then just scramble it completely. And now what is the wormhole dual to that? You know, is there a wormhole dual to that? And in fact, when you do this computation, you find the following set of results, and these are all CFT statements. You take this generic state and you compute the commutator of the mirrors with the OLs, and you find that it's suppressed up to order e to the minus s by 2. You find the two-point function is order e to the minus s by 2, but there are some operators on the left CFT, some generic or some complicated operators in the left CFT that have a non-zero commutator with the modes as seen by the right observer. So now we can't write down the geometry corresponding to this precisely, but roughly the geometry that you get is the following. You have a smooth horizon as seen by both the right and the left observers. The right observer jumps into the horizon. The modes as seen by this observer are not related in any simple way to the modes in the left CFT, which is what these relations tell you. And that's what this jagged line tells you, that, you know, in some sense, these two regions are just separate, but yet they're not completely separate. And that comes from this statement, which is a statement in the CFT, that there is some very complicated operation the left observer can do, which can, in fact, transmit information to the right observer behind the horizon. So this is a statement that colloquially you would say corresponds to having a very long wormhole. Now this is the precise version, the CFT statements, of the statement that you have a very long wormhole in the state. Okay, what about some other states? This is what we call the microcanonical double state. It's a state where you take almost a thermofield double state, but in the microcanonical with no Boltzmann factors, but instead by cutting off the energy range. This leads to what one might call a low bandpass wormhole. And the reason it leads to a low bandpass wormhole is because if you look at the two-point functions in the commutators, they have some behavior for low frequencies, where low is decided by this cutoff, and they have very different behavior for high frequencies. So for low frequencies, it looks like the modes as seen by the right infalling observer are the same as the modes of the left CFT, whereas for high frequencies, it's not the case. It looks like these are independent degrees of freedom. Now, once again, these are precise CFT statements, what I have on this slide. You might try and write down a geometry dual to this. That's an open question. This is a schematic picture of what you might expect the geometry to be. I emphasize this is schematic because there's no solution of Einstein's equations that has the right symmetries that corresponds to this. But roughly, you expect the geometry to correspond to an elongated wormhole of this kind, where low frequencies don't care about the fact that the wormhole has got longer than it is in the thermofield case, but high frequencies do. And therefore, the low frequency modes as seen by this infalling observer here correspond to low frequency modes dispatched from this side, but the high frequency modes are some new degrees of freedom that are generated by the spacetime. Okay. As I said, this is a schematic geometry. There are some solutions you can write down of this kind, but you have to add infalling matter and do something to make stabilize the solution. But that's not dual to the state that we want. But schematically, it looks like it has the right properties. Okay, good. So now, good. Let me just say one more thing about entanglement. Apart from analyzing, you know, when you get wormholes and how wormholes are related to entanglement, you can also use entangled systems to set up an important consistency check for state-dependent operators. The important consistency check is the following. The claim is you entangle the CFT with some set of qubits, not with another CFT, but with some set of qubits, and then you ask an observer to jump into the black hole and go and do some operations behind the black hole. And by means of such operations, the observer shouldn't be able to send superluminal signals to the set of qubits that exist somewhere else separately. And this was in fact devised as a test of linearity in quantum mechanics. It was devised by Kissin and Polchinski in the early 90s when there was this discussion of Weinberg's nonlinear quantum mechanics. And in that setup, if you prepared this system, where you took a system of qubits which had some m states, you entangle it with the CFT, you jump into the horizon, and then you do this excitation with this U tilde, in Weinberg's quantum mechanics, you found that the density matrix in this out state and in this in state of the qubits differed, and therefore you would get this superluminal propagation. So this lack of linearity could be transmitted, used as a resource to get superluminal propagation. In fact, our situation is not like that, and it's very important that in our case, if you take this system of qubits, you entangle it with the CFT, you find that as long as the dimension of the qubit system is much smaller than the dimension of the of the CFT, and that's when you can really expect to measure the full density matrix, the difference between the out and the in density matrix is zero. And this is the statement, and it's an important consistency statement, which is that state dependence is invisible to the infalling observer. And this is important. If I'm going to say that these operators, local operators, as measured by the infalling observer, correspond to some complicated measurables, which may depend on the state, then it's very important to avoid a contradiction with quantum effective field theory, that the infalling observer, by making experiments in effective theory, can't detect the state dependence. And this statement, by doing this test, tells you that this is indeed the case, that state dependence is transparent to the infalling observer. Okay, so mostly done. Let me take a few minutes more and just say a little bit about some possible semi-classical origins of state dependence. What I'm going to say now is somewhat more speculative, but this is the last thing I want to say. So let's go back to this set of time-shifted geometries, and I want to ask, can we understand state dependence from a semi-classical perspective of geometric quantization? So this time-shifted geometries, remember I told you they correspond to these large diffeomorphisms acting on the eternal black hole geometry. Because they correspond to large diffeomorphisms, you believe that you understand these mirror modes. And these mirror modes are just modes of shifted left operators. Not the original operators, but shifted operators, because that's what the large diffeomorphism does. Now, each of these shifted states, each of these time-shifted states is a solution to the equations of motion. Because it's a solution to the equations of motion, it's a point in the phase space of the full theory. And this set of time-shifted states gives you a one-parameter curve in the phase space of gravity. It's just a curve which is parameterized by this value of t. Usually, when you have a function, when you have a classical, when you have a classical function on some part of phase space, as you do here, because we understand what the mirror modes are at each of these points in phase space, you can often lift classical functions in phase space to operators in the theory by means of this construction. This is what's called the Sudarshan Mehta representation or quantization of functions in phase space. There's a Weyl representation. There are other representations, all of which differ by operator ordering ambiguities. But the point is that given a function in phase space, you can often lift it to an operator in the quantum theory. And you might ask whether you can do that here. But you can't actually. And the reason you can't is because if you look at the usual procedure of going from phase space to functions, to operators in the Hilbert space, it relies on the fact that coherent states, so points in phase space, have a certain inner product that dies off in a particular way. In this situation, you can compute the inner product of these different shifted geometries. It's a CFT computation, so you can do the computation exactly. You find that it goes like e to the minus n squared t squared. The C is the specific heat of the CFT. There's some computation you can do. But this computation gets cut off at some times, and in the end, you get a fat tail. You get a fat tail which is small, but there is a fat tail. So the exact answer looks like this. It has a fat tail, this orange curve, and the semi-classical expectation is this blue curve. But because you have this fat tail, this whole expansion of trying to lift these functions to operators that are defined on the entire curve in phase space fails because it doesn't converge. And what you get instead is that you can define these, you have these functions in phase space, and you can quantize them, but you have to quantize the solutions patchwise. and that you can quantize a range of solutions about t equal to 0, you can quantize a range of solutions about t equal to e to the n squared, and you can quantize a range of solutions about t equal to minus e to the n squared, but there's no operator that corresponds to this function on all of this one parameter family of phase space. And if I had to give a slogan for this, I would say that coherent states are always overcomplete. Usually the overcompleteness of coherent states is not an obstacle to lifting functions, classical functions, to operators, but in the case of gravity, the CFT states that correspond to semi-classical geometries, which is what you would believe are dual to coherent states, are even more overcomplete than ordinary coherent states, and then you would expect from this, from semi-classical analyses. So I'm out of time, so let me just summarize and then I can stop. So I just wanted to summarize the following. There's an old information paradox, but there's been a lot of work recently saying that the resolution to the old information paradox, which was that small corrections would resolve it, is not correct, and in fact you might need big corrections to the geometry of black holes. But the resolution to this modern information paradox is that you have to be careful about the structure of local operators in quantum gravity. In fact, I think the major takeaway from this modern information paradox is that local operators in quantum gravity are state dependent in this subtle way, but it's important when they are state dependent that the state dependent not lead to any inconsistencies, and indeed you can resolve these inconsistencies and you can check that it doesn't lead to any problems within effective field theory, and it does lead to some interesting consequences such as this, this concrete realization of this ER equals CPR proposal, and there are some reasons you might expect just from a semi-classical analysis of geometric quantization to expect this state dependence. So there are many open questions though, and one important question I think, which is a question that goes beyond our construction, is what is the measurement theory of these state dependent operators, given that you shouldn't be allowed to add these state dependent operators to the Hamiltonian. And I want to emphasize that this is a question that goes beyond our construction. It's a question that would exist anyway in quantum gravity. What is the measurement theory of local operators in quantum gravity? And then there are questions, such as I talked about this whole notion of operator algebras which were truncated, but it would be very nice to make that whole theory of truncated operator algebras precise, and that's because there is so much literature in the mathematical quantum field theory world on this Tomita Takasaki theory, and it would be nice to make a precise connection with that, but for that we have to make this theory precise. And then, of course we would like to understand not just equilibrium and non-equilibrium states, but also all sorts of other states. It would be nice if there was some unified prescription that let us do that. And of course, this whole notion of, a fat tail in the inner product leading to state dependence, whether it arises in other contexts in geometric quantization and what significance there is. And I think it may arise in other cases. But I think that there are some interesting open questions, but I'll stop here because I'm already over time, and then we can take questions.
Does state dependence of operators have interpretational implications for quantum mechanics?
Yeah, that's the question of what the measurement theory of these operators
right.
is. It's a good question. I don't know the answer to that question. What is the measurement theory of these operators? I want to emphasize that this is a question that goes, well beyond. It's a question about operators in quantum gravity anyway. The moment you accept the fact that the eternal black hole is dual to this entangled state of two CFTs, you could ask, you jump in and you measure. So you have an infalling observer who jumps in and measures the modes here, but you know that the operators he's measuring here correspond to modes sent from this side. But therefore, his measurement procedure shouldn't correspond to adding these operators to the Hamiltonian, because if he did that, you would be able to send signals between this side to this side, and that's not allowed because these CFTs are entangled but non-interacting. So it's a general question about operators in quantum gravity. Whether it has questions for the interpretation of quantum mechanics, I don't know, but there is a precise question about what is the measurement theory of local operators in quantum gravity. You can talk about their correlation functions and so on, but clearly a more precise measurement theory is required. There is a question there, I think.
Well, maybe it's a similar question, but because usually you worry about nonlinearities, and I think as you mentioned, this kind of we can't have a theory which is nonlinear for a number.
Sorry, I can't hear you.
Well, it's very dangerous to have a theory which is nonlinear for a number of reasons. But it's our ability to prepare the coins. But so, were you saying that an observer that's crossing the horizon can't cannot detect this nonlinearity
yes.
strictly, or just that it's a proxy?
Well, so we can't. I can't make any statement about exponentially small corrections. So within effective field theory, and certainly within all orders in the 1 over n expansion, you can make it. These operators are not visible, but it's, I can't make any statements about exponentially small corrections to that. And you're right. I mean, and in some sense, we were forced to this. No, it's not nonlinearity in a sense, because the evolution of the state still goes according to the boundary Hamiltonian, and the boundary Hamiltonian is still completely linear. So there's a completely linear system of quantum mechanics that describes the setup. Now the question is, you have an observer who goes and he jumps in. You have an infalling observer. He jumps into a particular microstate. And what is it that this infalling observer measures? And the claim is that what he measures, the physical thing that he measures, corresponds to a more complicated observable and not to some simple Hermitian operator. So it's not like the evolution is nonlinear. So I want to distinguish it from that. But it's true that he measures this. But even there, you have to be careful that you can't detect this state dependence in effective field theory, or you would really get observable contradictions. And the claim is that you can't, at least to all orders in the 1 over n expansion, you can't.
So again, kind of a similar question, possibly. So in algebraic or constructive QFT, you also have a certain state dependence of the operators, right? Because
yes.
you construct the Hilbert space in terms
yes.
of the state.
Yes. Yes.
Is your state dependence possibly of this kind?
Yeah, it's slightly different. You're right. There's this discussion of the state dependence. It goes by this name of this Korn cocycle in this even in this Tomita Takesaki theory. There's this discussion of what's called the Korn cocycle. It's a slightly, it's actually even stronger state dependence than what we have, because in our case, I wanted to emphasize that our operators remain constant in this little Hilbert space that we define. But in this discussion, the operators don't even remain constant in this little Hilbert space when you do this, you try and construct operators in the Hilbert space in that language. So it's an even stronger state dependence in a sense. Physically, somehow the situation, in that setup, somehow what you're concerned about is writing down some version for the commutant and writing down the Hilbert space. And there are several properties that don't care about the state dependence. In the end, the Hilbert spaces that you get are isomorphic and so on. In this case, we are talking about something that's more physical. What is it that the infalling observer measures, which is not a question that... It's a question you could have asked in that language when you try to do, for example, this construction of the left half of Rindler space using the right half using these constructions. You could have asked, what is it that the left Rindler observer measures? But it's not a question that's asked too much in that literature, although there is some. But the discussion is more about what remains invariant under that state dependence. And it's true, many things do remain invariant. So I just want to say there are two differences. One of them is that the question we're asking is slightly different. And second, the state dependence is slightly weaker.
Are there any other questions? No, let's stand.